Tonight's program is an interactive town hall, and we welcome your questions at the microphone. We encourage short, one-part questions that are actually questions. And our moderator, Dr. Gloria Duffy, will tell you when the appropriate time is to line up on the side of the room to ask your questions. Lastly, I remind everyone that the Commonwealth Club is a nonpartisan organization, and we ask that our speakers be allowed to make their remarks without interruption. And now, please welcome Kim Zetter, Dr. Joseph Felter, Council General Sergei Petrov, and Dr. Gloria Duffy. Dr. Abbas Milani will be joining shortly. Thank you.
Good evening. Testing. Can you hear me? Okay. Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us this evening for our town hall meeting entitled Confronting ISIS. As Kimberly said, we're waiting for Abbas Milani. Actually, we won't wait for him. We're going to incorporate him in the discussion when he arrives. He's driving up from Stanford, where the traffic that I just passed through is very bad. So we'll get going, and then he'll join in. As it was mentioned, this is an interactive town hall meeting. You'll go to the mics in order to pose questions. I'll ask you to keep those comments short so that we can get in as many as possible. We'll also go a little longer than our normal program tonight, since this is a topic of great interest and great concern. So just depending on how it goes, we may go as late as 8:30. Normally, we'd go from 7 to 8, so I'll sort of take signals from you as to whether we're going on too long. We will edit it down for our radio program. But we do want to get as much discussion as people want to have here tonight. You know that you can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. You know that I'm Gloria Duffy, the president and CEO of the club. Let me introduce my fellow panelists. To my left is Sergei Petrov. He's the Consul General of Russia here in San Francisco. He's a longtime diplomat who served in the Foreign Service of the Russian Federation, and we're very happy to have him here tonight. There are obviously very interesting questions regarding U.S.-Russian relations in dealing with ISIS in general and the situation in Syria and Iraq. To my far right is Joe Felter. Joe is a PhD. He's also a retired Special Forces Colonel. He's a senior research scholar at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford. And to my immediate right is Kim Zetter, who is an award-winning senior staff reporter at Wired Magazine, covering cybercrime, privacy, and security. And as we talk about approaches to dealing with ISIS, we're obviously living in a world of modern technology where the terrorist groups are adopting social media, the internet, and other ways of recruiting adherents, communicating among themselves. So we wanted Kim to be with us to talk about that aspect of the issue. I'll introduce Abbas Milani now, and then since he'll be coming in the middle of the discussion. He's a director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and co-director of the Iran Democracy Project at Stanford. And here he is, just on cue.
Perfect timing.
So thank you. Welcome. I've just finished introducing the panel. This is Sergei Petrov and Kim Zetter and Joe Felton here.
Hello.
And now we have our full complement, so let's go. We're going to have a bit of a discussion among ourselves, and then we'll introduce the questions from the audience shortly. One last thing I wanted to mention. The Commonwealth Club put out a call on the internet which many of you received as attendees of this program or members of the club, asking folks to suggest ways to confront ISIS without at least American boots on the ground in Iraq or Syria. This is obviously one of the major questions of the hour. What can we do without becoming militarily involved, since we've just been militarily involved and still are in Afghanistan and have been in Iraq? I think this is a question that many people are asking. And we got many responses. We do have some copies of the responses we've gotten with a number of creative ideas that folks submitted. We'll ask you to think about that question as well while you're here and offer any thoughts or ideas. We're collecting those. We will then put those without names attached somewhere where people can read those and think about those ideas. And so we invite you to particularly think about that question and offer your thoughts. What can we do without military action involving our troops? So let me start with a question for the panelists, and anyone can dive in, or you can wait for the next question up if it's more suited to you. What do you believe is the threat from ISIS today to the United States and to the world community?
I think it's the most serious threat I have seen coming out of the Middle East. I think they're going to challenge the very structure of the international community. They are keen on redividing the map in the Middle East, are creating new frontiers, although they don't believe in frontiers. And I think their ability to mobilize is remarkable. And with that ability, they threaten to disrupt the fabric of democracy in Europe. There's never been as many Muslims in Europe as there are now. And the events of today that might be connected somehow to this show that they even have a reach across the oceans. And how that will pay out, to me, is really a remarkably daunting challenge.
Mr. Consulton.
Yes, I I agree with Doctor. And I am not a doctor here among doctors, many doctors. I am more like a practitioner, but I will speak more like a human being. And what's frightening for me with ISIS is that they are killing people so easily. And they are putting the value of human life lower and lower. And that's very frightening for me. And another thing that that is dangerous, in addition to what Dr. Abbas said, Dr. Milani said, that I think, and he will correct me if I'm wrong, is that they are disrupting the right version of Islam. So Islam is not a religion that promotes hatred or death like any other religion in the world. But these people who are raising flags of Islam are doing exactly that. And they are changing the way we see Islam. That is also very, very dangerous.
Well, I don't have the academic expertise that the other guests have. I don't have an expertise in counterterrorism. But I would think that from the obvious perspective of what we've seen so far in Paris and in other attacks that have occurred is the biggest difficulty that we have in addressing the threat from ISIS is its lack of centrality or a central organizing structure. It's like Al-Qaeda in that regard, but even more, I think, decentralized, because you have a lot of cells that are operating completely independent of any kind of organizing structure, and that's really difficult to combat, because if you're trying to monitor communications and trying to focus on who are the right actors that are going to be, that present the most imminent threat, it's very difficult because your surveillance has to be very scattered in that regard, and I think that's one of the most trying obstacles that we have.
Just reinforcing what's been addressed so far, this is a very disturbing and very serious threat, I think, that ISIS actually has demonstrated what I would call an asymmetric strategic bombing capacity, where they can centrally plan operations and have decentralized execution, and that's a really, really difficult to defend against. You know, certainly Paris and the downing of the Russian airliner, many other attacks are just examples of just how lethal and potent ISIS can be and how difficult it is for their targets to defend against it. That said, I think there is some room for some limited optimism when we think of the threat of ISIS as a state, as an actual organization trying to hold territory. They're really not doing so well. They've lost, you know, 25% of their territory from their high point. They don't have any friends. They got a lot of enemies in the neighborhood. You think about the Kurds, the government of Iraq, Assad regime, coalition forces, Iran. They're in a tough neighborhood without a lot of friends. And they really have demonstrated that they don't have the capacity to govern. There are a bunch of self-selected fighters that come to Iraq and Syria to fight. And now when they try to govern, they're having challenges. You know, you need expertise, you need engineers, you need administrators, and that's very challenging. So I think ISIS as a state, I think we're going to see its demise at some point with certainly some more violence along the way. But going on your point, I think, Kim, that ISIS as an idea, as a brand, as a decentralized organization, as a hostile ideology, if you will, that's inspiring self-directed attacks in the West, in the U.S., and around the world, that's a serious threat, and that's something that's going to be very difficult to defend against. It certainly doesn't lend itself to any military solutions. It's going to have to come from within Islam. I think that's what Sergey's saying. This is a challenge from within Islam that's going to be the only place that you can address that nature of the threat.
Let's talk about that for a second. So what are, and I'm going to ask Dr. Milani to address this, what are the tenets of belief within Islam of ISIS? And we've heard, you know, certainly anti-women, we've heard of, you know, yes, jihadist, etc. But how would you characterize the belief system?
Well, they're very good at articulating their belief systems. They're one of the most sophisticated in terms of putting out their ideology. They publish a magazine in several languages. They have now added Russian to one of the languages where they are proselytizing. And their ideology, ironically, although now I hear the Saudi government is suing anybody who says ISIS ideology is similar to the ideology of the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, but I think you can't understand ISIS unless you understand a form of Islam that says there is only two sources for an absolute, unchanging truth. One is the literal interpretation of the Quran, not any other kind of interpretation. You can't read it as metaphor. Literally, if Quran says slavery is permitted, slavery is permitted. If Quran says you can marry two, three, four wives, I'm almost verbatim quoting their ideology, then you can marry two, three wives. And then secondly, something that Muslims call hadith. Hadith are stories about the Prophet, and a correct hadith, what they think is a correct hadith, is an absolute, unerring, exhaustive source of wisdom and salvation. Nothing else matters. And only form of Islam they accept is the form of Islam that was practiced during the Prophet's life. Every form of Islamic government post the Prophet is a form of heresy, if not apostasy. That's why they're called Salafist. They want to go to the ways of the past, and the only past they want to go to is the prophetic past of the life of the Muhammad, of the Prophet. So in that sense, their ideology is rather simple-minded, but extremely unbending, and in some ways frightening.
Where did this branch of Islam come from within Islam?
In terms of ISIS, the source, I think, has to be absolutely sought in Saudi Arabia, because it's in Saudi Arabia that Wahhabism arises. And all of this, in a sense, is a response to the beginning of the defeat of Islam. Islam used to be a major contender on the world scene. Islam came all the way to Europe. Islam was a main challenge to Europe. Islam came all the way to the outside of Vienna in 16th century. When they realized they were no longer a contender, a group of them, and you have them in Saudi Arabia, they're called Wahhabis, you have them in Iran, they're called something else, but they began to say, we need to go to the ways of the past. We don't want modernity, we don't want rationalism, we don't want democracy, we don't want the nation state. And all of these things, they say, are constructs of Western colonial crusaders. And so you have some version of it in Egypt, you have some version of it in Iran, in 16th, 17th century, where people begin to say, we only accept the Quran and only the Hadith. You have it in Saudi Arabia, you have some version of it in Egypt, in the Muslim Brotherhood. All of them have one thing in common. Nothing other than what is in the Quran, literally, and what is a good Hadith matters.
So there's some sense, I think, that taking away the odious dictatorial role of Saddam Hussein somehow spawned this disorganization in Iraq and Syria that allowed this brand of Islam to rise up. The chaos in Iran and in Iraq and Syria allowed this to gain more ground. Is there any truth to this? Do you feel that this is part of the reason that it has gained a foothold in an actual geographical area, as is the case in Iraq?
Well, you know, what was the origins of ISIS, which was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, was virtually defeated by the United States when they killed Gaddafi. Then they moved to Syria. They moved very well in chaos. And in Syria, they found several things they liked. They found Iraqi military personnel that had been, in my view, foolishly disbanded by the Americans. They found Saddam intelligence agencies who had been trained by the KGB, who had been trained by the Stasi, and brought all the ferociousness of the worst form of despotism. They combined that with mafia techniques they had learned. Many of these people were thugs, including Gharzavi. So you combine mafia with Stasi, with some dose of salvation, and internet, that's a potent mix.
And oil.
And lots of money from oil companies, oil-rich families, at least.
So in this recent round of ISIS terrorism, the downing of the Russian airliner was probably the first major strike. How long had Russia been tracking and aware of ISIS? Was this event a complete surprise? Was Russia in some ways unprepared for this? Tell us about how the Russian government has paid attention or not paid attention to ISIS and the reaction to this airliner incident.
Unfortunately, we are always not prepared to something like that happening. But if we speak about specifically about ISIS, I would say that my government was tracking it for quite a long time. And ISIS was included as one of in the list of the terrorist organizations. It didn't happen, as far as I know, here or in Europe, but in Russia it happened. And ISIS is to be affiliated with ISIS, it's a crime. And we recently had a situation when a group of young people were detained in the city of Stavropol. Because they had some education and training abroad, and they came there and they studied in a medical school, and their mission was to hire possible fighters for ISIS. And they were detained and they were arrested, and they would go through a judicial procedure and put into prison for that. Yes, we were tracking ISIS and other radical Islamic groups, terrorist groups in Russia for quite a long time. And unfortunately, we had our experience, a sad experience with terrorists from Chechnya. They were many, and they were not just locally grown. They acted like ISIS acts now, with the help, with the outside help, be it financial resources or weapons or some expertise. And we had our moments. We have many victims in Moscow, in the other cities of Russia, but we hadn't had any direct contact with ISIS until it happened with the airliner. And even when it happened, I think we wanted very much, my government wanted very much for it not to be a terrorist act. That's why we were not ready to announce it to be a terrorist act right away from the very first day. So a detailed procedure was executed to find out what happened. And after we happened that it was an explosive device, and when it was announced who prepared this explosive device, so it was, the outcome was the decision that it happened with the help of ISIS. I think that we'll have more threats coming our way. And what Dr. Milani said, that ISIS is now introduced Russian as one of the languages they disseminated their propaganda. But I think it would not stop us from trying to stop this evil. And we are ready to go all the way, fighting ISIS either ourselves or with the help of other governments. And actually what we are trying to do for quite a long time, my government, is to build an international coalition that would take, not just militarily try to destroy ISIS militarily, but to formulate and to execute a complex approach that would include eliminating sources of financial support for ISIS, destroy their headquarters, destroy the oil refineries, illegal oil refineries they had, and many, many other ways we can weaken them. But definitely it would be more effective, much more effective, if we have a combined effort in this field. That's definitely not the end. The Paris, I would be happy if Paris tragedy was the last terrorist act we see. But definitely it's not the last one, and we could face even more dangerous things, like we discussed this. They could use chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, dirty bombs, cyber equipment to bring even more destruction for us. So the only way for us is to be together to do something about that.
Just to dwell on Russia for a moment, why would they pick Russia? Is it to appeal potentially to Islamic minorities in Russia, to agitate them in some way? It seems a little unusual. Usually the US and Western European countries are more the target for our decadent, qualities. And Russia seems unique as a choice. Why Russia?
I'm smiling because I just had a couple of days ago same question from from my colleague from Germany who was asking me why they did it to your plane. We all know that in Syria you are bombing opponents of Assad. You're not bombing ISIS. That was all media says. That's what media say. Why are they? Why have they chosen your plane to down? And that's exactly shows that our military operation in Syria is effective. That shows that we are starting to hit the nerve and the bulk of ISIS. And that's why they started to target Russia as a retaliation. And that's a completely wrong understanding that we are not doing anything against ISIS in Syria now. But that's what would you read in many, many reports about what's happening in Syria. Most of the hits by the Russian aviation is targets either ISIS or groups affiliated with ISIS. It's Jihad al-Nusra, I think, or other groups that are same kind of terrorists with weapons trying to kill people.
Let me switch to Joe for a second. What do you feel that the type of bombing campaigns that are going on now have a real potential to stop ISIS? So we're bombing some of the oil convoys and we're bombing leadership targets, supposedly. What can you tell us about the air war that's going on, and will it be sufficient?
Well, it certainly isn't an end in itself. It's part of a needs to be part of a comprehensive strategy, both military and governance-oriented. Certainly, if ISIS masses in the open and it lends itself to being targeted, absolutely, we need to have a responsive bombing capability to address that. But the real challenge here is it's a targeting issue. ISIS, they're occupying urban areas. They're with civilians, the civilian population. And they know that if we bomb them in these urban areas and have a lot of Muslim civilian casualties, that plays right into their narrative. So bombing can be very counterproductive to our interests and play right into the hand of the of ISIS interests if we end up killing Muslim civilians, and that, of course, that goes viral on the internet and all their propaganda methods. But so bombing is important. It is a capacity we need to maintain. If they lend themselves to being targeted, they need to be targeted. We need to turn on the heat and make it very difficult for them to operate, for them to do any kind of command and control or resupply of that nature. But we can't lose sight. I mean, I've spent some time in the military, and you know, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. There's a lot more to this challenge. It's you can't bomb your way to representative governance in Baghdad, and that was a real challenge in Iraq. When the Sunni population of Iraq was like, well, we don't really like ISIS, but what is our own government going to provide us? So I think bombing certainly has its limitations. But it is a key component to a comprehensive strategy. We just can't kid ourselves that it's going to be the only instrument that's going to get us where we need to be.
One of the front burner questions right now is whether we should back off on trying to undercut President Bashar al-Assad and essentially accept that situation in Syria as a way of combating ISIS. Do you have a view on that?
Well, I know our president, our government has made it clear that you know, Assad is not an acceptable ruler. But that said, I would, you know, there's other, maybe more immediate threats that we might want to address first, and maybe put that one aside. And certainly, the elephant in the living room, in the room here is going to be that very issue with Sergei. I know his country has very different interests here. So yes, I think focusing on ISIS may be more pragmatic, but it's certainly the end state that we've stated and that we were not going to be satisfied without is a future of Syria is not going to include Assad.
So let's talk about technology and the internet for a second. There have been various mentions of ISIS using the internet very well. What's your impression of how sophisticated ISIS is in terms of using social media, using the internet? What's their reach? What's their digital reach?
I don't think that they're any more sophisticated than any PR team. You know, they understand the value of social media in outreach, geographical outreach. They understand the value, obviously, of pictures with the beheadings, obviously, and the threat videos that they've created, where production values are pretty good on that. They're not geniuses. I mean, there's nothing special that they're doing that other groups don't do. They're doing things that we haven't seen other terrorist groups necessarily doing. So ISIS represents sort of this new generation that's grown up with technology and has used it, you know, individually for their own purposes in the way that teens and 20-somethings use technology, and they're simply adapting that for their needs here. I think that, you know, one of the things, the impulse seems to be to try and take down that kind of digital activity, to take down websites, to take down social media accounts, things like that. But that's actually one of the ways we track them. I mean, there's a double-edged sword there. They're using it for recruitment and things like that, but that's also a focus that surveillance can have to monitor conversations that are going on forums, to actually infiltrate those forums. We see it with this cybercrime forums as well. I mean, those are crawling with undercover feds, and that's what they're, you know, they're infiltrating them. And so on the one hand, you need those forums as sort of a centralized point to actually understand, in some regards, what they're up to.
So the hacker group Anonymous has announced that it's declared war on ISIS, and they're supposedly taking down websites and Twitter accounts and so on. Is that possible? And B, you seem to be saying maybe that's not desirable.
Well, I think it's problematic when Anonymous is doing it, because what kind of vetting are they doing? I mean, how are they determining that an account is an account that poses a threat in some regards? And you know, there have been reports that they've actually taken down sites that are operated by academics who are doing research in the field, and they're probably taking down undercover sites that the military is operating in, that intelligence agencies are operating as well. So I think that their involvement sort of messes things up a little, because they don't really understand the environment in which they're operating, and really taking down websites and taking down Twitter accounts doesn't accomplish much. It's whack-a-mole. You take down one and another pops up. So
we're gonna continue this discussion, but I'd like to invite the audience to participate, and again, there's a mic over here. And we can pass it around, or feel free to go up there to the mic. And so let's just start adding in some audience questions. Mr. Petrov?
I would like to add what Joyce said. I think that if we now try to do something, want to try to do something serious to reach some tangible results in fighting ISIS in Syria and Iraq, we definitely can't do it with just using air force. That would not be impossible. And just a couple of days ago, there was an article in San Francisco Chronicle about this underground holes that they prepared even before all this started. So they will go down there and they will spend some there. No, you wouldn't find them with bombs or cruise missiles. So we definitely need somebody to be on the ground. So who could that be? The United States, I don't know. It seems like the United States is not ready to send troops there. Russia is definitely not ready. We still remember Afghanistan, Soviet Union, and I have an exchange with one of my friends, who when he sees a piece of news like a group of Russian special forces went to Syria, he said, "Aha, that's your troops are there." But we had a bet with him that I am sure 100% that Russia would not send troops there, ground troops that would fight ISIS. So who could that be? Our view is we only can use local people to fight ISIS. They would be able to do that. And local people, who would that be? That would be countries of this region. And that brings us to Iraq, to Syria, to Iran probably, for them to be engaged in some kind of ground operation. If we speak about Syria, we have to find the solution to this, in my understanding, very inflexible position not to accept the government that exists now in Syria. Okay, it's legitimate government that that is recognized by all countries, by the United Nations. Why wouldn't we cooperate with that? We don't like something about the leader of this country, but it's up to the Syrian people to decide that. And we have very effective political process going on, by the way, with the help of very effective help of combined efforts by the United States and Russia. Vienna process, and I hope we'll find a way to support the political process there and to allow people of Syria to decide in future of their own fate. But if we speak now, I completely agree with Joe that we have an immediate threat of ISIS, and we need somebody on the ground, and this somebody, or part of this somebody, is definitely the armed forces of Syria, the present armed forces of Syria, and that we should use. Otherwise, we would not be able. We stop our bombing, and we'll have all these terrorists back again.
Thank you.
It's not that simple, unfortunately. The armed forces of Syria have killed almost 300,000 Syrians. The armed forces of Syria have virtually helped destroy the country. They have helped displace some 10 million people. Assad was never, in my view, a legitimate ruler. He was elected in an obviously rigged election. People have voted with their feet, people who have left the country. The notion that Assad enjoys some legitimacy, I think, is a figment of imagination. He might be useful, but he's not useful because he's legitimate. He's useful because he has a military. But the problem with using the military of Assad is that Assad's military has now been supported by Iranian IRGC. Mr. Soleimani is there. Hezbollah is there. And if Sunnis in Syria are as afraid of Hezbollah, are as afraid of the Quds Brigade as they are of Assad. And one point about Chechnya and why they chose Russia, there are no countries that have contributed more to ISIS in terms of number of people than Chechens. There are 2,000 Chechens fighting there. And they're fighting there because the Russian government went after the Chechens. You call them terrorists, they call themselves independent nationalist fighters. One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. But the Russian government went with remarkable power to put down Chechens. And the Chechens, this is a pattern. These people get beaten one place, they pick up and go and fight somewhere else, and then they'll come back and haunt Russia. These 2,000 people, if ISIS is beaten, if ISIS is driven out of Syria, where are they going to go to? Where are these Chechens going to go to? They will create havoc, unfortunately.
But they were, I must say, they were also creating havoc in Russia.
Yes, but
yes.
If I may comment on that, we keep hearing about moderate opposition to Assad, just the recent example on you probably know November 24 the Russian bomber was shot down by the Turkish fighter. When the pilot went down on a parachute, this moderate opposition shot the pilot in the air. When they got his body, they said that they would exchange this body for some fighters from the prisons. So I don't think that these people could be called moderate opposition. Those people who takes weapons in their hands and fight legitimate government, even if this government is not right at this moment, they have no right to do that. If you mentioned that there are 300,000 casualties in Syrian civil war, that's right. But if you look at the composition of these casualties, you will see that half of them is members of the military and security forces of Syria. Okay, if anybody here in this country or in Russia takes weapons in his arms and start killing soldiers, what government will do?
So I'm going to, we'll get back to this, but we have a long line of folks who'd like to ask questions. So, and if you want to direct it to any particular person, please do so.
Well, with the competing allies of U.S., NATO, and the Russian Federation, how can we find a way of working together without coming into direct military conflict like Turkey and escalation?
Thank you.
Yeah. I would say that this unfortunate incident with Turkey was something very unexpected. And if we speak about, for example, of Russia and the United States, there is an agreement in place, agreement for some time, operational agreement, that allows Russian Air Force and U.S. Air Force to act in harmony in Syria, not to threaten each other. And after it in tragic accident happened with Turkey, there was an incident of a Russian airliner entering not airliner but a fighter or bomber entering Israeli space, but nothing dangerous happened. It was just a mistake. There was an exchange of information, and everything was okay. So I think that we have every possibility to act together, be it operation in military operation, or even more in exchange of intelligence. Which is, I think, even more important now, because when we are told, I mean, Russia is told that we are not bombing the right targets in Syria, okay, give us the targets that you think we should bomb, the targets where ISIS is. We are asking for this information from our NATO and US partners for quite a long time. We haven't received it yet.
Yes, ma'am.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay. This is a question, and it's dedicated to the entire group. Considering the misogyny of the Islamic State, as well as Al-Qaeda and Taliban, et cetera, do you think a strategy to bring ISIS to its knees could be threaten to educate all Muslim females, elementary, secondary, college, and graduate school, and back that up with a monetary fund? Thank you.
Okay, good idea. Let's try Dr. Milani, but also everyone, anyone who has a view.
Yesterday, a remarkable lady from Morocco died. Her name is Fatima Mernissi. She spent a lifetime trying to do exactly that, educate Muslim women, bring them into the education system. Her belief was that the way to liberate Islamic societies is to bring women into the fold. I absolutely believe that if there is to be a salvation for Islamic societies, women have to take the leadership. The only country where they have done that, and we see signs of it, is Iran. In Iran, Iranian women, in spite of the misogyny of the regime, are now at the forefront of the democratic struggle. And if there is to be democratic salvation for the Muslims, the issue of women has to be solved. And it can't be solved with an ideology like ISIS, or with an ideology like Saudi Arabia, or with an ideology like the Iranian regime that says the life of a woman is worth half the life of a man. But women are on the march. The good news is.
Other comments?
So absolutely, that's a laudable goal, and it should be part of a long-term plan. But clearly, the much closer in target, if you will, it'll be hard to address that. So I think that is a great initiative on so many levels, but we can't expect that to solve some of the problems we have right now. And I think undermining support for ISIS, you could do that by ensuring that those on the margins appreciate that, you know, their vision for women's education and empowerment is pretty bleak. So that could help in the near term as far as limiting recruitment. But those types of activities, we still need to solve some problems right now, which is the immediate crisis, and these attacks could happen, you know, today, based on the ISIS threat.
I'm all for women. I'm all for raising the role of women in every society, including the U.S. I'll leave it at that.
Yes, sir.
I would like to add what Joe said, that bringing women, I agree absolutely, and solving this issue of women in Islam. But there are all other challenges that we should deal with. It's education. It's healthcare. It's many other things that we should do to this exactly region in the world for it to stop to be conducive to produce terrorists. But it's definitely a long-term goal. But again, it's not something that a rich country as the United States could do, because it would be expensive even for the United States. But it should be a joint efforts of all the countries that are interested in stopping this evil for good.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is David Katsky. I recently joined the Commonwealth Club. I'd like to make a comment of the topic of ISIS, just the name itself. Islamic. How could we in good conscience continue to associate these psychotic barbarians, terrorists, and rapists as being associated with one of the major established and respected religions of the world? Wikipedia says the following about the word Islam. The adherent of Islam is called a Muslim. These are barbarians, not Muslims. They are terrorists. And then state. Just because they declare themselves to be a state, we cannot continue to acknowledge these psychotic terrorists as such. If we continue to identify them as ISIS, that is precisely what we are doing. I propose that henceforth we identify them for exactly what they are, terrorists occupying Iraq and Syria.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Agree. I agree.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi there. My name's Maura. I have a question. It's already been discussed a little bit, but I want to be more pointed about it. And it relates to Assad. And it's not for the Russian gentleman. It's for the other people in the room. Palace, because we know where you're going to stand.
It
on
sounds
that.
Like a discrimination.
No. Absolutely not. I want to be direct in, like, has the U.S. been, I'm going to say U.S., U.K., whatever, been actually foolish in being focused on Assad? And I ask that for a few reasons, contextually. Like, one, America has not had a great record of backing the most democratic leaders around the world. You know, from Noriega to, I mean, today, you know, with the Egyptian rulers. So that's, like, one point. And I think, you know, the second point is we haven't even asked, really, the Syrian people who are going off to Europe, like, what really, we asked them, okay, you know, what are you going to do in Europe? But really, what do you want the remedy of your country to be once you, you know, ISIS is kind of led away? But also, you know, militarily, how do you fight a war with a triangle strategy? Because the UK right now is, you know, discussing today about, like, well, we want to have a clear goal. We want to have a clear goal. If we're going to go in, we want to know how we're going to get out. But if you have a triangle of people, you know, war is usually, you know, here's your foe, and that's who you're going after. So that's my question.
Okay, any takers?
Well, you know, since you excluded that I have to speak for His Excellency here. You know, if you go back, and I know he would disagree with me, but I think if you go back to the origins of the Syrian crisis, it began actually with peaceful demonstrators being shot at by the Syrian government. Those peaceful demonstrators were moderates. Those who shot at your airplane were murderers. They are not moderates. Anybody who shoots at a pilot who is coming down and is not a moderate. But the people who were in the street and wanted a peaceful election were moderates. Assad, like his father, does not tolerate moderate Democrats. It is a despotic regime. It does not tolerate democracy. And in this case, once he refused to accept that, others began to come in. Iran decided to come in. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey decided to come in. Everybody has decided to come in. Everybody has contributed to this remarkable chaos. Nobody, unfortunately, has a record that is very defendable and is very clean. Russia has defended Assad. Iran has defended Assad. Saudi Arabia has poured in hundreds of millions of dollars into arming these people. Turkey has opened its borders and allowed thousands of these people to go through Turkey. Everybody, I think, has unfortunately contributed to the creation of this remarkable tragedy. And I don't know, I mean, we have a Persian expression that says it takes one mad person to throw a stone down a well. It takes 10 wise people to take it out. Now, so, 10 foolish people have thrown several stones. It's going to take the whole of humanity to take it out.
So let me ask a question this way. What would happen with ISIS if Assad was no longer there in Syria? Better or worse than we see now?
It depends on how Assad is not there. If Assad is not there as a result of a negotiated transition to a more inclusive, not to a Sunni extremist, not to a Shiite extremist, not to a Christian extremist, an ecumenical, democratic, inclusive society, then I think ISIS has a chance of being defeated. If you replace one form of despotism with another, then murderous phenomena like ISIS flourish.
All right, next.
Thank you. My name is Alice Anderson, and I have a question actually for the whole panel. And it's, in fact, I have two separate questions. And the first is, has anyone considered the possibility of implementing sister city relationships between the cities of the rest of the world and the villages and towns of Syria and Iraq, so that there could be targeted support by many municipalities of these small areas that are under focus? That's my first question.
Responses?
I think it'd be a nice effort in principle, but you could have a sister city that's under ISIS control and all your goodwill would still be kind of stuck at the door there. I think it'd be hard to get some of that goodwill into these at-risk areas where it's most needed for a variety of reasons. Certainly good in principle, but I think in execution in some areas would be really difficult to. We're trying to bring aid and support in some of these areas, but it's just very challenged by the political conditions.
I'll leave the notion on the table. And the second sort of observation, I guess, that I have is this, that I don't hear, with respect to recruitment, it almost feels as though ISIS has thrown down an honor challenge to young men who may be swayed across the world. And the honor challenge is something along the lines of, you can be a secret agent for God and sacrifice yourself if you like, you know, but we are challenging you at your deepest core to prove who you are. And that's almost a propaganda, that is, in my view, a propaganda question. And I don't know that there is an effective effort at a counter-propaganda which says, there is a whole other future for you, and there are things that we can do, and there is something that you can offer the world that does not involve sacrificing yourself. And I just wanted to leave it at that.
Let me take your question about sister city relationships. into a different realm. Is there a way to establish more direct contact or have a more direct role in Syria and Iraq that might be productive, say, through technology? Is there any way for people to make contact with other elements of the societies in those countries along the same lines of establishing direct contact that might be positive?
I suppose that you can do things like what the Voice of America tried to do during the early wars, but something that wouldn't be propaganda from the U.S. We were talking earlier about the distortion of Islam. And I think that the Muslim community has a role to play here in countering. They are multitude strong, and they could take on this role of sort of the counter propaganda and really police what's happening in their communities a lot better to counter that. And technology would be one way to do that. Certainly.
Do we see any signs of that yet? What is the attitude and what are the steps taken by more moderate Islam in relation to ISIS?
I think that may be a question.
Dr. Milani?
Yes.
ISIS, according to a poll, has only the support of 0.2% of Muslims. 99.8% of Muslims have said that they don't like ISIS. ISIS doesn't win by election. ISIS wins by terror. That 0.2% is what they're going after. And they're precisely offering them employment. They pay between $400 to $600 for soldiers, up to $2,000 for their commanders. They provide them with sex, not rock and roll, sex. I really mean that. Internet and... You can take whatever you want in a war. You can take whatever woman you want. You can enslave the woman. You can sell it if you like. And if in the process you die, you go to heaven and become a martyr. And we are giving you the dignity you have been deprived. They literally say this. They say, we are going to create a society where a Muslim fighter can be proud to be a Muslim fighter. That's a very dangerous proposition. And when you have in Europe xenophobia, when you have Ms. Le Pen and Mr. Trump here suggesting at the slightest unhappiness that Muslims should be all registered, that is precisely what plays into the hands of ISIS. ISIS has a theory, folks. It says we need to eliminate the gray zone. We need to eliminate the illusion that Muslims can live peacefully in the West. And how do you do that? You create mayhem. The other side begins to create anti-Islamic propaganda, anti-Islamic policies. They begin to put people in prison. They begin to take people off Southwest flights simply because they spoke Arabic. That creates the kind of vicious circle where they thrive.
Can I come? There's a text by an author, Abu Bakr Naji, called The Management of Savagery, which it's literally a playbook, if you will, for ISIS. It's exactly what Abbas was saying. It plays right into their narrative. They want to create this, Muslims are under attack, and it's your duty to come to its defense. And to do that, you come to the caliphate. It's just a word of caution. For example, if we go on an all-out bombing campaign and there's pictures of Muslim women and children casualties plastered around the internet, that's going to play right in the jihadi narrative. And to the other point, I forget exactly the question, you're right, this is propaganda, but to discredit and delegitimize this propaganda, it can't come from most of the people that look in this room. It is got to come from that 99.8%, is that
yeah.
it? and somehow, and those ideas are out there, and I think that the challenge now is how we can amplify those arguments that do, in fact, from within Islam, discredit and delegitimize this very virulent propaganda that's driving these young men and even women to do these horrible things in the name of ISIS and their religion.
For those listening on the radio and watching on TV and the internet, this is the Commonwealth Club of California's broadcast, and tonight we are holding a town hall meeting on confronting ISIS with Consul General Sergei Petrov of the Russian Federation, Joe Felter, Senior Research Scholar at CSAC at Stanford University, Dr. Bas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford, and Kim Zetter, a Senior Staff Reporter at Wired Magazine. Yes, sir.
Yes. Getting back to this idea of sister cities, I was thinking about that. I think that would be definitely a great idea, but lots of resources should be given to for these exchanges. That's if it's supported by the federal governments with some resources, that would be a great idea to befriend cities and to for them to exchange ideas, to educate each other. That would be a great idea. But about moderate Islam, for those who doesn't know, Russia is a Muslim country. We have millions of Muslims living in Russia peacefully. Only small portion, like Dr. Milani said, probably some 0.4% were radicals, extremists, and turned terrorists in Chechnya, and we had to deal with them. Maybe not as effectively as some other countries, but that's what we did our work. And Chechnya is now a comparatively peaceful place to be. But we are investing hugely now in supporting the Islam, moderate Islam. And the recent example of that was a mosque that was inaugurated in Moscow. It's, I think, if I'm not wrong, is the biggest mosque in Europe that was opened in the center of Moscow, allowing thousands of Muslims that live in Moscow to be able to be loyal to their religion. And many more mosques are being built in Russia, and religious schools, and we try to promote that as we promote other religions. We try to include Muslim leadership of Russia in all the discussions about, like all leaders of other religious communities in the discussions about what we can do joint joint way to fight against terrorism. I think that's the only approach that we can have. If we have a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew who takes weapons in his arms and kill people, we have to stop it, no matter what religion he is. And if we speak about normal people who want a peaceful life, we should again support it, no matter what religious it is. Yes, it turns different now, and we sometimes look at Muslims as a threat, all Muslims, which is completely wrong in my understanding.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Robert Sinaway, and I have a question for the panel. I'll give you the question, and I'll give you the background as to why I asked the question. You always talk of ISIS as a religious movement, but is it a religious movement? Is it a political movement? Or is it the Fifth Brigade or Crusade? remember, the Americans, Madeleine Albright had this famous comment about 500,000 Iraqi children that died because they couldn't get medical support. I don't know what the figures, it seems like it's very high, but anyway, that's what I heard. The American army invaded, over 200,000 Iraqis were killed, I understand. Now, that figure is not complete. But then, could you think about the fact that these children belonged to parents? The men that died belong to husband or wives. We have made widows and orphans, and I don't think ISIS can hold a candle to what we did. Is it right to say it's Muslim, or is it more specific to say it's Arab, because that's where it is in the Arab countries? Your comments, please.
Thank you very much.
I was hoping a boss might jump on that one.
we'll get there.
So I think that, again, going back to the narrative that I think ISIS wants to use, is that the West is attacking Islam, that they are doing all these horrible and atrocious things. So that's certainly, you know, even if we end up sending ground troops, I think it in many levels that would play right into the ISIS narrative, because the more opportunities they have to, whether it's using propaganda or you know, real accurate photos of tragic events, the more that they can blame the West and mobilize Muslims, young, again, it's generally the demographic is Muslim young men, to take up this call to arms that they have. So your question, should it be called Arab? I don't know that I think ISIS goal, its stated goal is to establish the caliphate and expand it, you know, well beyond its current borders. Yeah, well, I think that, you know, their only supporters, these are Sunnis. These are Sunnis.
Yeah.
But so it's a specific question, or I just want to make sure I'm getting the question. Say again, please. No, I may have missed the question. I want to make sure.
You're saying it's a Muslim thing because they're using that Muslim label, but it doesn't have to be. I'm more concerned with their motivation and how they got to where they are.
Okay.
It doesn't automatically mean that they are a Muslim organization that is out to kill people. There's 1 billion Muslims in the world. They can find Muslims anywhere they want to if they look for Muslims. So I understand that Muslims even come from the United States to join ISIS. That's what I understand. I don't know. I can't corroborate that. But they're coming because they're Muslim. But ISIS doesn't have to be a Muslim organization. It could be a political organization. Besides, the vacuum that we created by getting rid of Saddam Hussein is responsible for the birth of ISIS. No question about that.
Actually, that's a very interesting question. So why don't we have the panelists discuss that? How does that decision to get rid of Saddam Hussein look in retrospect?
Well, I would say compounded with, you know, what you know, Maliki did when we left, and the fact that Baghdad, if you're a Sunni in Iraq post when Maliki was in charge and after the U.S. troops left, you didn't look to your government as offering the kind of future you wanted for you and your family. It really wasn't out for your interest. So I think certainly taking Saddam out created that vacuum. We filled the vacuum with this Shia-dominated government. If we could have had if somehow the end result could have been a more representative governance that did not disenfranchise the Sunnis, I think that would have been key. But the truth is, if a Sunni Iraqi looks to Baghdad as Shia-dominated, Iranian-dominated, and no future for the Sunnis. They may not like ISIS, but they may hate them ever slightly less than their own government. I think that's a real challenge. In counterinsurgency, there's a saying that we have that, you know, counterinsurgency can only be as good as the government it supports. And ultimately, this isn't a security issue. This was that power vacuum that was created when Saddam was taken from power, but it's what replaced it, which was not representative and disenfranchised the Sunnis and gave them a lot of propaganda to recruit, and or at minimum allowed the Sunni communities to tolerate ISIS, if not support it.
So we have about 10 more minutes, so let's get a few more questions and then we'll have some final comments. So yes, ma'am.
Well, this is a similar question in a way. It's about the possibility of a political dimension as contrasted with a military dimension to confronting ISIS. The most creative solution that I have read was in the New York Times, where an op-ed columnist suggested redrawing borders to some degree and actually creating a Sunni state, which would draw Sunni support that may not be really aligned with ISIS, but like Joe just said, you know, ISIS looks better than the Shia governments that they've that have been imposed on many people. Is that naive? Is that realistic? What do you
think? Very good question. What about the creation of a Sunni state?
Well, there is already a Sunni state. It's called ISIS. They have carved out, they really have carved out of Iraq and Syria, the Sunni parts, and they're ruling it. But whether the current maps of the Middle East will survive this chaos, I think is a very good question. I think my guess is that the current borders are not going to survive. You're going to see new configurations. And the question of whether ISIS is political or religious, you have to read their own literature to decide whether they're political and religious. They say our religion is our politics is our religion. They're not separated from one another. You can say that in your understanding of Islam, they should be separated. Many people would agree with you, but that's not what ISIS says. ISIS says our politics is our religion is our politics, and it is a crusade. You're absolutely right. They do accept it. If you're looking at the origins of ISIS, you shouldn't look at the fall of Saddam. Every major player in ISIS came out of Afghanistan. When the United States decided to support anyone who would fight the Soviets, so long as they fought the Soviets, they brought in bin Laden, they brought in Gaddafi, they poured in billions of taxpayers' money to train these people, and when they defeated the Soviet Union, they decided to go after the United States. So if there is a point to begin, it isn't the fall of Saddam, it is Afghanistan, and the notion that anyone who fights my enemy, I'm willing to support. When Ronald Reagan called the Mujahideen, like our founding fathers, that is either a failure to understand who these people were or playing loose with facts of language.
Mr. Yeah. Petrov.
Yeah, unfortunately, I agree. We
unfortunately?
No, I say unfortunately. Unfortunately, what you say, but I agree with what you say, that we keep, we have a saying in Russian, наступать на те же грабли. We keep repeating the mistakes, same mistakes all the time. About ISIS, I think maybe in the long run it's more like a crusade or political organization or religious organization, but and maybe I stole the what Joe said already, is that now it's a huge business. It's a huge business. People there are just making money on this business. And that's what they do. They extract oil, they sell it for some prices lower than the prices, world prices, and they get our calculations, they were getting $3 million a day for only oil. But they are doing other things as well, with drugs, with because it's nobody's terrain. You can grow drugs, you can do anything there. So now when we started hitting, us and French started hitting their oil infrastructure, the calculation that the money they receive now is two times less, but they still receive $1.5 million a day for what they're doing just with oil. My understanding and our understanding that that's the way we, if we see them like that, we have a way to fight them like that. We should stop this business. We should stop those who buy this oil. And there are people who buy this oil in not just in Syria and Iraq, but outside, and they are getting part of these profits. And we should stop them using this money to buy weapons. And they are buying weapons from us. From outside, not from inside, not inside. So, and they are doing it through the channels of, okay, banking systems of the world. So if we can do that, I think we could be at least we would at least weaken them to a very great extent.
One more question, and then we'll have some closing comments.
Hello, my name is Douglas Evans, and I have a brief question that goes to Kim's early comment that ISIS is somehow just like Al-Qaeda and that it's decentralized. I thought their goal was to create a caliphate, and that to have a caliphate, you need a caliph, just the same as to create a kingdom, you need a king. Isn't it more true that they've actually articulated an intensely centralized control structure that requires a lot of infrastructure to support?
Yeah, so you're talking about sort of the political structure of it, and I agree there that that's centralized. What I was talking about are the terrorism cells that are operating in multiple countries, like Belgium and France, and likely in the U.S. as well. And where you have then cells that can operate independent, they all have the same goal, they all have the same ideology. They don't necessarily need instructions from abroad. In the case of the Paris attacks, there were reports that some of that was conducted from Syria, from one of the operatives who was based in Syria, but you don't need that. You have individual cells who can operate independent of that. They just need training, which they're getting when they go abroad. They're gonna need weapons, obviously, but the actual communication and planning doesn't have to come from any kind of centralized structure, and that's what I was referring to.
And unfortunately, we are very close to being out of time, so, all right, one more. I'm sorry.
Thank you. My name is Avner, and I have I'd like your comments for a practical solution or to reduce or eliminate the suicide bomber and gunman of Daesh, ISIS terrorists, is when it was practically used successfully, officially and unofficially by other countries before, is to bury their corpses wrapped with pigskin, and that will deprive them from the fruits of paradise.
All right, well, we'll just take that as a comment. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you. So let's have one last comment from each panelist. What is one thing that you would like to see done by the U.S. or any other entity or group that would help to undercut the current threat from ISIS? One thing, top priority.
So I have an international relations background at Stanford, and one thing we learned is that you, in international relations theory, you worry about strong states, and that's who the U.S. should worry about, other strong states in the system. But I think we've kind of turned international relations theory on its head, and it's actually still need to worry about strong states, but it's the weak states that can really threaten us. And I think we can't separate, you know, the military security solutions with the ultimate end state is about governance. So ISIS, you need to provide, in this case, the Sunnis in Iraq and Syria, a better alternative to supporting or at least tolerating ISIS. So let's not focus on the security solution to the point we lose sight of the fact that the military options, the security solutions are only to empower a better strategy for more representative governance that will give people a better option than ISIS.
Kim?
I think I would go back to what I had said earlier about encouraging the larger Muslim community to develop some kind of counter to what's happening there. I think that they have a lot of power. I think that part of the problem of them not organizing is because they feel attacked from the outside and don't feel empowered to basically take this into their own hands. Obviously, they can't fight ISIS, but they can counteract it in their own communities.
Thank you. Mr. Petrov.
Yes, I would like to see as soon as possible a decision by the UN Security Council for the countries of the world to be together to fight terrorism, and not just militarily, like Joe said, but to have a comprehensive strategy of how we deal with this evil, together and what we'll do for it not to be reborn. And one important thing of that would definitely definitely should be that we should think about people who are in the ground, who are in the planes, who are in the military, and even those who are with ISIS now, because many of them are just many young people disillusioned. Many of them, by the way, we our calculation, it could be 2,000-3,000 people who went from Russia there. And many of them did they by mistake, and that would be a tragic mistake of their life. So we should ensure that they are back to normal life and they would not repeat this again.
And final word to Dr. Milani.
Well, my hope is that somebody, somewhere, decides to actually begin to think about this thing seriously, because I don't think people have been thinking about this seriously. This needs a strategy that is as complicated, as nuanced, as multifaceted as the reality that begot it. ISIS is a result of multiple crises, a crisis of identity, a crisis of legitimacy, crisis of economics, crisis of people's movement, crisis of theology. And unless people and governments begin to develop a strategy that includes mobilizing moderates, includes educating the Westerners, includes educating American students about the basic facts of life about Islam, then I think we are in for a very long hot summer.
I'd like to thank our panelists, Dr. Milani, Kim Zetter, Joe Filter, and Sergei Petrov. I'd like to thank our audience here in the room who have posed some very interesting questions. Those who sent in their ideas for non-boots-on-the-grounds approach to dealing with ISIS, our radio audience, our internet audience, and this is an incredibly important topic that we all need to be thinking about and think about what our individual roles are in trying to solve this problem. Thank you for coming here tonight to exchange views. And this is the end of our town hall for the evening. This meeting's adjourned. Thank you all very much.